Chapter 6, Capitalism, by Matthew Desmond. A couple of years before he was convicted of securities fraud in 2017, Martin Shkreli was the chief executive of a pharmaceutical company that acquired the rights to Daraprim, a life-saving anti-parasitic drug. Previously, the drug had cost $13.50 a pill, but in Shkreli's hands, the price quickly increased by a factor of 56 to $750 a pill. At a healthcare conference, Shkreli told the audience that he should have raised the price even higher. "No one wants to say it. No one's proud of it," he explained. "But this is a capitalist society, a capitalist system, and capitalist rules. This is a capitalist society. It's a fatalistic mantra that seems to get repeated to anyone who questions why America can't be more fair or equal. But around the world, there are many types of capitalist societies. Some are more equitable, and some are more exploitative. Some more restrained, and some more unregulated. When Americans declare that we live in a capitalist society, as a real estate mogul told the Miami Herald in 2018 when explaining his feelings about small business owners being evicted from their Little Haiti storefronts, what they're often defending is our nation's peculiarly brutal version of capitalism, low-road capitalism, the University of Wisconsin-Madison sociologist Joel Rogers has called it. In a capitalist society like ours, wages are depressed as businesses compete over the price, not the quality of goods. And so-called unskilled workers are typically incentivized through punishments, not promotions. Inequality reigns and poverty spreads. The United States stands today as one of the most unequal societies in the history of the world. The richest 1% of Americans owns 40% of the country's wealth, while a larger share of working-age people, those 18 to 65, live in poverty than in any other nation belonging to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. The OECD, an international consortium of democratic countries with market-based economies, scores nations along a number of economic indicators, such as how countries regulate temporary work arrangements and how easy it is to terminate employees. Scores in these categories run from 5, very strict, to 1, very loose. When it comes to regulations on temporary workers, Brazil scores 4.1 and Thailand 3.7, signaling that in those countries, workers enjoy a range of 2-3 protections. Farther down the list are Norway, 3.4, India, 2.5, and Japan, 1.3. The United States scores 0.3, tied for second to last place with Malaysia. What about how easy it is to fire workers? Countries like Indonesia, 4.1, and Portugal, 3, have strong rules about severance pay and reasons for dismissal. Those rules relax somewhat in places like Denmark, 2.1, and Mexico, 1.9. They virtually disappear in the United States, ranked dead last out of 71 nations with a score of 0.5. Those searching for reasons the American economy is uniquely severe and unbridled have found answers in many places: religion, politics, culture. But recently, historians have pointed persuasively to the natty fields of Georgia and Alabama, to the cotton houses and auction blocks, as an early example of America's low-road approach to capitalism. As a source of the fledgling nation's financial might, slavery shaped our political institutions and founding documents, our laws governing private property and financial regulation, our management techniques and accounting systems, and our economic systems and labor unions. By the eve of the Civil War, the Mississippi Valley was home to more millionaires per capita than anywhere else in the United States. Cotton grown and picked by enslaved workers was the nation's most valuable export. The combined value of enslaved people exceeded that of all the railroads and factories in the nation. In the mid-1830s, New Orleans boasted a denser concentration of banking capital than New York City. Small wonder, then, that American slavery is necessarily imprinted on the DNA of American capitalism, as the historians Sven Beckert and Seth Rockman have written. The task now, they argue, is cataloging the dominant and recessive traits that have been passed down to us, tracing the unsettling and often unrecognized lines of descent by which America's national sin is even now being visited upon the third and fourth generations. Colonial America was a relatively prosperous society. The southern colonies were the wealthiest, as white planters reaped high returns on staple crops like rice and tobacco. But the revolution left the colonies broke and vulnerable. Incomes plummeted in the final decades of the 18th century, and if the states could not come together to form a national government, they would be susceptible to foreign invasion and economic collapse. In the spring and summer of 1787, representatives of each state met in Philadelphia to draft a constitution and found a new nation. The delegates were deeply polarized over a host of issues, none more contentious than slavery. When the revolution began, slavery was legal in all 13 colonies. But during the 1770s, voices condemning human bondage had grown louder throughout New England and Britain. By the time the framers began writing the Constitution, states that did not rely heavily on enslaved labor within their borders, like Massachusetts and New Hampshire, had already outlawed it. On the other hand, states like Virginia and Georgia vehemently defended the right to own and sell black people. At several points, the issue of slavery ground the Constitutional Convention to a halt, and both Northern and Southern representatives threatened to dissolve the Union altogether. As James Madison, the father of the Constitution, observed on June 30, 1787, the states were divided into different interests, not by their difference of size, but by other circumstances, the most material of which resulted partly from climate, but principally from their having or not having slaves. What pro-slavery advocates feared most was democracy itself, that Northern majorities would use the power of the federal government to dismantle slavery. This fear shaped our political institutions in ways still felt today. To protect slavery, Southerners fought for and won several provisions that all but ensured that majoritarian rule over the South would be impossible. On May 29, 1787, Governor Edmund Randolph of Virginia rose and proposed that congressional representation be based on population and not the one vote per state rule that had governed the Articles of Confederation. Northern and Southern delegates debated whether black enslaved people should count toward a state's population until the so-called Great Compromise was proposed in July. Congress would be divided into two houses, a lower house based on population, with each enslaved black person counting as three-fifths of a citizen, and an upper house that gave all states an equal number of votes. The Southern advantage conferred by the three-fifths clause was extended to the executive branch through the Electoral College, proposed by Madison, which provided each state a number of electors that aligned with its representation in the lower house of Congress. Slaveholding states secured outsized political power in both Congress and the presidency, which was controlled by pro-slavery advocates until the election of Lincoln in 1860. The Constitution empowered all states with a practical veto on national policy, according to historian Mark Graber, which made it effectively impossible for the federal government to regulate slavery without the South's consent. To this day, the 15 states where slavery remained legal as of 1861 still hold the power to block a constitutional amendment supported by the other 35. So if Washington often feels broken, that's because it was built that way. A 2011 study of 23 long-standing democracies identified the United States as the only country in the group that had four veto points empowered to block legislative action: the president, both houses of Congress, and the Supreme Court. Most other democracies in the study had just a single veto point. In those nations, parties govern, pass policies, and get voted in or out. Things happen at the federal level. But the United States government is characterized by political inaction, and that was by design. By creating political structures that weakened the role of the federal government's ability to regulate slavery, the framers hobbled Washington's ability to pass legislation on a host of other matters. Chief among these was taxation. If they wished to raise an army and fund the government, the framers also had to devise a way to levy taxes on the citizenry. But delegates couldn't agree on the best way to do this because slavery kept getting in the way. It was impossible to debate taxes without also debating how to tax the enslaved. Should enslaved black workers be taxed as people or property or not at all? The three-fifths clause provided a potential solution: treat enslaved black workers as partial citizens for the purposes of taxation. But Southern enslavers quickly realized that that would require them to pay more than Northerners who didn't enslave people. For example, if the federal government established a poll tax levied on every person, in 1790 the three-fifths apportionment would have mandated that a Virginian be taxed $1.39 and a South Carolinian $1.45 for every $1 charged to a free Northerner. Predictably, Southerners rejected this plan. "Our slaves being our property," argued South Carolina Representative Thomas Lynch, "why should they be taxed more than the land, sheep, cattle, horses?" Lynch and other Southerners wanted their human property to count toward their congressional representation, but not against their tax bill. The delegates finally decided that imports should be taxed. It was a tax everyone could agree on. A tariff could be levied without reference to slavery because it didn't require counting enslaved workers or estimating the value of their products exported to other countries. Merchants would foot the bill and pass the cost on to consumers. In this way, the tax was invisible and often optional, in the sense that you can decide to purchase an imported good or not. Though politically palatable, the import tax stunted the bureaucratic infrastructure of the nation, allowing the United States to neglect developing the administrative systems necessary for progressive taxation and government services. The result was the creation of a financially and bureaucratically weak federal government. It was not until 1861, when the bill for the Civil War came due, that the nation was finally forced to establish an income tax and an Internal Revenue Service to collect it, originally called the Bureau of Internal Revenue. The American public, which had never been made to pay income tax, reacted unkindly to this fledgling agency, calling it inefficient and corrupt. After the war ended, so too did the national income tax. Congress passed a modest income tax almost 30 years later, in 1894, but in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. The federal government didn't acquire the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes until 1913, when the 16th Amendment was ratified. By 1900, an income tax supplied roughly 12% of government revenue in Italy and the United Kingdom, and about 20% in Germany and the Netherlands. Imagine if the United States had followed a similar path, establishing the Internal Revenue Service not in a moment of crisis, but at the nation's founding. In this alternative universe, the IRS could have been given adequate financial backing and administrative support, enabling it to function efficiently and fairly. Taxes would not have been hidden in American consumerism, as was the import tax. Rather, they could have been transparently collected as a portion of each person's income and seen as a patriotic duty, an investment in the nation. But, of course, this is not our history. Progressive taxation remains among the best ways to limit economic inequality, funding public services like schools and healthcare, and incentivizing business to work for the common good. America's present-day tax system, however, is regressive and insipid, in part because it was born out of political compromise steered by debates over slavery. This generates inequality and enables large corporations to avoid paying their fair share, or any share. In 2018, 60 Fortune 500 companies, including Amazon, Chevron, Delta Airlines, and Netflix, paid no federal income taxes. Slavery shaped the Constitution in profound and lasting ways. "One consequence," writes the historian Robin Einhorn, "may well be the exceptionally powerful devotion to individual property rights that made American business stronger, American labor weaker, and the American welfare state a comparative laggard." Private property is the cornerstone of capitalism. It is what allows someone to own a factory or a corporation, a piece of land or an apartment building, and to secure profit from the workers or tenants who do not own such assets. It is what allows the luxuries purchased from those profits to be protected by the full weight of the state. It is what enables a private landowner to fence off natural resources and forests and rivers, assets that originally belonged to no one and were stewarded by the surrounding community, transforming common goods into commodities controlled by a single person or business entity. Capitalism depends on private property, and private property depends on the law. When private property extends to human beings, however, a particularly strong and expansive set of protections is required. Human beings, after all, can run away or revolt. The founders recognized this, and in the Constitution they safeguarded the human property of those who owned enslaved people through a number of provisions. Article 1, Section 8, granted Congress the power to summon the militia to suppress insurrections, understood to mean rebellions of the enslaved. Article 1, Section 9, forbade Congress from ending the slave trade until 1808. Article 5, Section 2, prohibited free states from emancipating runaways. Human property in the South would remain human property in the North. The framers helped create a doctrine of private property strong enough to justify and enforce human trafficking, so much so that abolitionists publicly burned copies of the Constitution. The importance of this specific kind of private property, enslaved people, was both enshrined in the Constitution itself and affirmed by the Supreme Court's interpretations of the highest law of the land. After the Constitution was ratified in 1788, in case after case, the court protected private property in general and slavery in particular, sometimes going to extraordinary lengths to deny black freedom in the name of ownership rights. The 1812 case, Hezekiah Wood versus John Davis and others, concerned the situation of John Davis, a black man born to a mother who had never been enslaved. According to the law of matrilineal descent, this should have established Davis's own freedom, but Wood, an enslaver who claimed Davis as his property, argued that he had purchased Davis before his mother had proven her freedom. The court sided with Wood. The following year, the court's decision in the case of Mima Queen and Child versus Hepburn denied black people the right to provide hearsay evidence that supported their freedom claims, prioritizing the propertied interests of enslavers over the lives of people those enslavers claim belonged to them. The court's vigorous defense of human bondage, encased in property law, continued as amendments were added to the Constitution. The Fifth Amendment, which prohibited Congress from depriving anyone of life, liberty, or property without due process, informed the Supreme Court's decision to uphold slavery in its infamous 1857 Dred Scott v. Sanford case. Born into slavery, Dred Scott was moved to Alabama and Missouri, then to Illinois, before once more returning to Missouri. Having relocated from a free state, Illinois, to a slave state, Missouri, Scott sued his putative owner for his freedom, citing the state court doctrine of once free, always free. The case pitted Scott's liberty against his enslaver's property, and when the Supreme Court heard the case, the justices ruled in favor of bondage. The court decided that manumitting Scott would infringe on the property rights of his enslaver. Slavery, then, required the magic of property. As historian Stephanie Jones Rogers documents in her book, They Were Her Property, elite white women were particularly invested in securing a jurisprudence that valued white property over black freedom because their economic independence and influence depended on it. Southern parents tended to give their daughters more enslaved hands than land. Slavery demanded a legal defense of ownership rights much more far-reaching and severe than would have been necessary to secure, say, a house or a herd of cattle. Houses do not attempt to become non-property by running away. Cattle do not stage armed revolts. But humans, treated as property, were constantly doing both. After the Civil War, legal provisions originally developed to protect slavery were extended to strengthen corporate interests and promote laissez-faire capitalism. The Fifth Amendment's language protecting private property resurfaced in the 14th Amendment, ratified during Reconstruction, which established legal and civil rights for black Americans by mandating equal protection of the laws and prohibiting states from denying people life, liberty, or property without due process. It didn't take long for corporate attorneys to realize that the 14th Amendment could help strengthen business interests too. This was affirmed in 1886 by Chief Justice Morrison Waite, who plainly stated before oral arguments for Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company that the Supreme Court believed that the 14th Amendment applied to corporations as well as to people. The 14th Amendment became the most cited amendment in Supreme Court cases, leaving a profound impact on private law. A 1912 study found that of the 604 14th Amendment cases decided by the Supreme Court, more than half involved corporations and largely protected their power, including by striking down attempts to end child labor and establish a minimum wage. Less than 5% of those cases concerned the rights of African Americans, who lost nearly all of the cases they brought. Once again, white ownership interests took precedence over black freedom and safety. One of the most consequential 14th Amendment cases was Lochner versus New York, 1905. Joseph Lochner, the owner of a bakery in Utica, was fined by New York State for violating a labor statute that prevented bakers from working more than 60 hours a week, or 10 hours a day. Lochner appealed his case, and when it was heard in front of the Supreme Court, the justices ruled in his favor, finding that extending protections to bakery workers would infringe on the property rights of bakery owners. Today's law students are taught that Dred Scott and Lochner were wrong, but the court's defense of corporate personhood has continued to the present day. In 2010, the court ruled in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that corporations' political speech, including independent expenditures, spending in support of a candidate for office without making a direct contribution, was protected by the Constitution. The 2012 presidential election that followed Citizens United received nearly 600% more independent expenditures than the previous presidential election in 2008 had. Of course, the founders could not see this far ahead, how the political concessions made to protect human property in the Constitution would fundamentally shape the nation's economy and the political institutions that governed it. Just a few years after all 13 states ratified the Constitution, American life changed utterly and invariably. The cotton gin was invented. Before the gin, enslaved workers grew more cotton than they could clean. The gin broke the bottleneck, making it possible to clean as much cotton as you could grow. This helped to ignite the cotton trade, which had a profound impact on America's economic development. A key factor that made the cotton economy boom in the United States, and not in all the other far-flung parts of the world with climates and soil suitable to the crop, was our nation's unflinching willingness to use violence on non-white people and to exert its will on seemingly endless supplies of land and labor. Enslaved black workers picked in long rows, bent bodies shuffling through cotton fields white and bloom. Men, women, and children picked, using both hands to hurry the work but careful not to snap a branch. Some picked in Negro cloth, their raw product having returned to them by way of New England mills. Some picked completely naked. Young children ran water across the humped rows while overseers peered down from horses. Hands are required to be in the cotton field as soon as it is light in the morning, wrote Solomon Northup in his 1853 memoir, 12 Years a Slave. And with the exception of 10 or 15 minutes, which is given them at noon to swallow their allowance of cold bacon, they are not permitted to be a moment idle until it is too dark to see. And when the moon is full, they oftentimes labor till the middle of the night. Before the industrialization of cotton, people wore expensive clothes made of wool or linen and dressed their beds in furs or straw. Whoever mastered cotton could master textiles and make a killing. But cotton needed land. A field could tolerate only a few straight years of the crop before its soil became depleted. Planters watched as acres that had initially produced 1,000 pounds of cotton yielded only 400 a few seasons later. The thirst for new farmland grew even more intense after the invention of the cotton gin. The United States solved its land shortage by expropriating millions of acres from Native Americans, often with military force, acquiring Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and Florida. It then sold that land on the cheap, just $1.25 an acre in the early 1830s, $38 in today's dollars, to white settlers. Naturally, the first to cash in were the land speculators. Companies operating in Mississippi flipped land, selling it soon after purchase, commonly for double the price. Enslaved workers felled trees by axe, burned the underbrush, and leveled the earth for planting. Whole forests were literally dragged out by the roots, John Parker, an enslaved worker, remembered. A lush, twisted mass of vegetation was replaced by a single crop as American money exerted its will on the earth, bringing floods and erosion, erasing natural habitats, and otherwise spoiling the environment for profit. Cotton was to the 19th century what oil was to the 20th, one of the most valuable and widely traded commodities in the world. It gave rise to factories, vast manufacturing enterprises, and large industrial proletariat workforces, forming whole industries around itself. Unlike other staple crops grown by enslaved black workers, rice in coastal South Carolina and Georgia, sugar in Louisiana, cotton could be cultivated throughout the South, relied heavily on industrial production and was sought by consumers across the developed world. Together, cotton planters, enslaved workers in the South, wage laborers in the North, and millers and consumers from across the ocean helped fashion a new economy, one that was global in scope and required the movement of capital, labor, and products across long distances. In other words, one that was capitalist. The beating heart of this new system, Beckert notes, was slavery. During this period, Americans built a culture of speculation unique in its abandon, writes the historian Joshua Rothman in his book Flush Times and Fever Dreams. That culture would drive cotton production up to the Civil War, and it has been a defining characteristic of American capitalism ever since. It is the culture of acquiring wealth without work, growing at all costs, and abusing the powerless. It is the culture that brought us catastrophic downturns, like the Panic of 1837, the stock market crash of 1929, and the recession of 2008. It is the culture that has produced staggering inequality and undignified working conditions. As slave labor camps spread throughout the South, cotton production surged. By 1831, the country was delivering nearly half the world's raw cotton crop, with 350 million pounds picked that year. Just 4 years later, it harvested 500 million pounds. Southern white elites grew rich, as did their counterparts in the North, who erected textile mills to form, in the words of Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, an unhallowed alliance between the Lords of the Lash and the Lords of the Loom. As America's cotton sector expanded, the value of enslaved workers soared. In New Orleans, between 1804 and 1860, the average price of a male field hand aged 21 to 38 grew from roughly $500 to over $1,500 in 1830. Because they believed they couldn't grow their cotton empires without more enslaved workers, ambitious planters needed to find a way to raise enough capital to purchase more hands. Enter the banks. People could be sold much more easily than land, and in multiple southern states, more than 8 in 10 mortgage-secured loans used enslaved people as full or partial collateral. As the historian Bonnie Martin has written, slave owners worked their slaves financially as well as physically by mortgaging people to buy more people. Access to credit grew faster than Mississippi kudzu would after being ported at the end of the century, leading one 1836 observer to remark that in cotton country, money, or what passed for money, was the only cheap thing to be had. Centuries before the home mortgage became the defining characteristic of Middle America, Southerners decided to use the people they owned as collateral for mortgages and took on immense amounts of debt to finance their operations. The math worked out. The owner of a cotton plantation in the first decade of the 19th century could leverage his enslaved workers at 8% interest and record a return 3 times that. So, leverage they did, sometimes volunteering the same enslaved workers for multiple mortgages. Banks lent with little restraint. By 1833, Mississippi banks had issued 20 times as much paper money as they had gold in their coffers. In several southern counties, mortgages taken out on enslaved workers injected more capital into the economy than sales from the crops harvested by workers themselves. Global financial markets had powered the slave economy for years. When Thomas Jefferson mortgaged his enslaved workers in 1796 to build Monticello, it was a Dutch firm that put up most of the money. The Louisiana Purchase, which opened millions of acres to cotton production, was financed by Baring Brothers, the well-heeled British commercial bank. Most of the credit that powered the sectors of the American economy based on the labor of enslaved black people came from the London money market. Years after abolishing the African slave trade in 1807, Britain, and much of Europe along with it, was bankrolling slavery in the United States. To raise capital, state-chartered banks pulled debt generated by mortgages on enslaved workers and repackaged it as bonds promising investors annual interest. During slavery's boom time, banks did swift business in bonds, finding buyers in Hamburg and Amsterdam, in Boston and Philadelphia. Banks issued tens of millions of dollars in loans on the assumption that rising cotton prices would go on forever. Speculation reached a fever pitch in the 1830s as businessmen, planters, and lawyers convinced themselves that they could amass real treasure by joining a risky game that everyone seemed to be playing. If planters thought themselves invincible, able to bend the laws of finance to their will, it was most likely because they had been granted authority to bend the laws of nature to their will, to do with the land and the people who worked it as they pleased. As the historical sociologist Orlando Patterson once remarked, the slave variant of capitalism is merely capitalism with its clothes off. We know how these stories end. The American South rashly overproduced cotton, thanks to an abundance of cheap land, enslaved labor, and fast credit. Consumer demand didn't keep up with supply, and prices fell. The value of cotton started to drop as early as 1834, before plunging like a bird winged in mid-flight, setting off the panic of 1837. Investors and creditors called in their debts, and enslaved workers were taken from planters and sold by courts on behalf of creditors in an attempt to right the balance sheets. It wasn't enough. Mississippi planters owed the banks in New Orleans $33 million in a year their crops yielded only $10 million in revenue. They couldn't simply liquidate their assets to raise the money. When the price of cotton tumbled, it pulled down the value of enslaved workers and land along with it. Because enslavers couldn't repay their loans, the state-chartered banks couldn't make interest payments on their bonds. Shouts went up around the Western world as investors began demanding that states raise taxes to keep their promises. After all, the bonds were backed by taxpayers, leaving states on the hook for the enslavers' debt. Facing a swell of populist outrage, states decided not to squeeze the money out of every Southern family, coin by coin. Furious bondholders mounted lawsuits, but the bankrupt states refused to pay. The South chose to cut itself out of the global credit market, the hand that had fed cotton expansion, rather than hold planters and their banks accountable for their negligence and avarice. Some planters lost their shirts, others absconded to Texas, an independent republic at the time, with their treasure and their enslaved workforce. But many large-scale planters stayed put, drew on the reserves, and weathered the panic just fine. They knew that cotton prices wouldn't stay down for long. Global demand was simply too robust. The biggest planters owned not only more land, but better land. They could afford a recession and could even profit from one, turning short-term loss into long-term gain by storing their crop and selling as much as possible when prices climbed in bumper years. Planters and their banks took the risk, but others paid the price. Enslaved black workers paid for it, sold away from their families to settle debts. Small farmers, unable to borrow money and commit to the high-risk, high-reward business of cotton farming, paid for it, losing their land and livelihoods. Bank clerks and cashiers paid for it, committing suicide as debts went unpaid and their jobs dissolved. If slavery's economy sparked a culture of speculation unique in its abandon, as Rothman put it, it was in part because enslavers realized they can enrich themselves by breaking the rules with little consequence. Such side effects of capitalism, externalities, the economists call them, are routinely felt today. The Great Recession of 2008 caused the average black family to lose a third of its wealth, and most black businesses did not survive the downturn. Almost all of the major financial institutions responsible for that downturn, however, did survive. Slavery not only shaped America's political institutions, laws, and financial culture, it also helped mold modern management techniques. Historians have tended to connect the development of modern business practices to the 19th century railroad industry, viewing plantation slavery as pre-capitalistic, even primitive. It's a more comforting origin story, one that protects the idea that America's economic ascendancy developed not because of, but in spite of, millions of black people toiling on plantations. But management techniques used by 19th century corporations were very similar to those implemented during the previous century by plantation owners. Planters aggressively expanded their operations to capitalize on economies of scale inherent to cotton growing, buying more enslaved workers, investing in large gins and presses, and experimenting with different seed varieties. To do so, they developed complicated workplace hierarchies that combined a central office, made up of owners and lawyers in charge of capital allocation and long-term strategy, with several divisional units responsible for different operations. In her book, Accounting for Slavery, the historian Caitlin Rosenthal writes of one Jamaican plantation where, in 1779, the owner supervised a top attorney, a kind of financial manager, who supervised another attorney, who supervised an overseer, who supervised three bookkeepers, who supervised 16 enslaved head drivers and specialists like bricklayers, who supervised hundreds of enslaved workers. This organizational form was very advanced for its time, displaying a level of hierarchical complexity equaled only by large government structures like that of Britain's Royal Navy. Like today's titans of industry, planters understood that their profits climbed when they extracted maximum effort out of each worker, so they paid close attention to inputs and outputs by developing precise systems of record keeping. Plantation entrepreneurs developed spreadsheets like Thomas Affleck's Plantation Record and Account Book, which was first published around 1850 and ran into 8 editions. It circulated until the Civil War. Affleck's book was a one-stop shop accounting manual, complete with rows and columns that tracked per-worker productivity. This book was really at the cutting edge of the informational technologies available to businesses during this period, Rosenthal told me. I have never found anything remotely as complex as Affleck's book for free labor. Enslavers used the book to determine end-of-the-year balances, tallying expenses and revenues and noting the causes of their biggest gains and losses. They quantified capital costs on their land, tools, and enslaved workforces, applying Affleck's recommended interest rate. Perhaps most remarkably, they also developed ways to calculate depreciation, a breakthrough in modern management procedures, by assessing the market value of enslaved workers over their lifespans. Values generally peaked between the prime ages of 20 and 40, but were individually adjusted up or down based on sex, strength, and temperament. People reduced to data points. In her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, the historian Dinah Remy Berry shows that enslaved workers even had monetary value in death, their bodies sold as cadavers to medical schools and physicians. Detailed data analysis also allowed planters to anticipate rebellion. Tools were accounted for on a regular basis to make sure that a large number of axes or other potential weapons didn't suddenly go missing. Never allow any slave to lock or unlock any door, advised a Virginia enslaver in 1847. In this way, new bookkeeping techniques developed to maximize returns also helped ensure a monopoly on the tools of violence, allowing a minority of white people to control a much larger group of enslaved black people. American planters never forgot what happened in Saint-Domingue in 1791, when enslaved workers took up arms and revolted. In fact, many white enslavers overthrown during the Haitian Revolution had relocated to the United States and started over. Overseers recorded each enslaved worker's yield. Accountings took place not only after nightfall, when cotton baskets were weighed, but throughout the workday. In the words of a North Carolina planter, enslaved workers were to be followed up from daybreak until dark. Having hands line-pick in rows sometimes longer than 5 football fields allowed overseers to spot anyone lagging behind. The uniform layout of the land had a logic, one designed to dominate. Faster workers were placed at the head of the line, which encouraged those who followed to match the captain's pace. When enslaved workers grew ill or old or became pregnant, they were assigned to lighter tasks. One enslaver established a suckler's gang for nursing mothers, as well as a measles gang, which at once quarantined those struck by the virus and ensured that they did their part to contribute to the productivity machine. Bodies and tasks were optimized with rigorous exactitude. In trade magazines, owners swapped advice about the minutiae of planting, including diets and clothing for those they enslaved, as well as the kind of tone of voice an enslaver should use. In 1846, one Alabama planter advised his fellow enslavers to always give orders in a mild tone and try to leave the impression on the mind of the Negro that what you say is the result of reflection. The devil and his prophets were in the details. The uncompromising pursuit of measurement and scientific accounting displayed in slave labor camps predates industrialism. Northern factories would not begin adopting these techniques until decades after the Emancipation Proclamation. As the large slave labor camps grew increasingly efficient, the productivity of enslaved black workers increased at an astonishing pace. During the 60 years leading up to the Civil War, the daily amount of cotton picked per enslaved worker increased 2.3% a year. That means that in 1862, the average enslaved field worker picked not 25% or 50% more, but 400% more cotton than his or her counterpart did in 1801. Historians and economists have attributed the surge in productivity to several factors. For example, Allen Olmsted and Paul Rode found that improved cotton varieties enabled hands to pick more cotton per day. But advanced techniques that improved upon the ways to manage land and labor surely played their part as well. The cotton plantation was America's first big business, and the overseer was the nation's first corporate big brother. And behind every cold calculation, every rational fine-tuning of the system, violence lurked. Plantation owners used a combination of incentives and punishments to squeeze as much as possible out of enslaved workers. Some beaten workers passed out from the pain and woke up vomiting. Some danced or trembled with every hit. An 1829 first-person account from Alabama recorded how an overseer shoved the faces of women he thought had picked too slowly into their cotton baskets, then opened up their backs. There is some comfort, I think, in attributing the sheer brutality of slavery to dumb racism. We imagine pain being inflicted someone at random, doled out by a stereotypical poor white overseer, full of racist hate. But many overseers weren't allowed to whip enslaved workers at will. Such punishments had to be authorized by the higher-ups. It was not so much the rage of the poor white Southerner as the greed of the rich white planter that drove the lash. The violence was neither arbitrary nor gratuitous. It was a rational part of the plantation's design. Each individual having a stated number of pounds of cotton to pick, a formerly enslaved worker, Henry Watson, wrote in 1848, the deficit of which was made up by as many lashes being applied to the poor slave's back. Overseers closely monitored enslaved workers' picking abilities. Falling short could get you beaten, but overshooting your target could bring misery the next day, because an overseer might raise your picking rate. Planters' profits were harnessed through the anguish of the enslaved. Punishments rose and fell with global market fluctuations. Speaking of cotton, in 1854, John Brown, a fugitive from slavery, remembered, "When the price rises in the English market, the poor slaves immediately feel the effects, for they are harder driven, and the whip is kept more constantly going." In making possible the pursuit of nearly limitless personal fortunes at someone else's expense, slavery put a cash value on our moral commitments. Slavery and the racism it nourished also played a decisive role in weakening the American labor movement. Capitalists leveraged slavery and its racial legacy to divide workers, free from unfree, white from black, diluting their collective power. Instead of resisting this strategy, white-led unions embraced it until it was too late, undercutting their movement and creating conditions for worker exploitation and inequality that exist to this day. The large-scale cultivation of cotton by enslaved people hastened the development of the factory, an institution that propelled the Industrial Revolution and changed the course of history. In 1810, there were 87,000 cotton spindles in America. 50 years later, there were 5 million. Slavery, wrote one of its defenders in DeBow's Review, a widely read agricultural magazine, was the nursing mother of the prosperity of the North. The northern textile mills that spun cotton grown and harvested in slave labor camps helped usher in a new economic arrangement, one that required workers to sell not crops or goods, but bits of their life, their labor. Cotton manufacturing required people to give up their old lives and join the newly emerging factory proletariat. What should have followed, Karl Marx and a long list of other political theorists predicted, was a large-scale labor movement. Factory workers made to log long hours under harsh conditions should have locked arms and risen up against their bosses, gaining political power in the formation of a labor party or even ushering in a socialist revolution. Britain experienced a militant working-class movement throughout the 1830s and 1840s, while France veered close to the wholesale adoption of socialism during the Second Republic, 1848 to 51. An American labor movement did emerge in the 19th century, but it failed to bring about the kinds of sweeping reforms and political transformations that remade Western Europe. Had socialism taken root in America, perhaps the country would have adopted a kind of social democratic capitalism that combined a market-based economy with big state investments in public education and social welfare programs. Perhaps workers' wages would be considerably higher and CEO compensation considerably lower. Income inequality decreases when unionization increases. As a result of organized labor fighting for better pay for the rank and file and keeping employer power in check. But socialism never flourished here, and a defining feature of American capitalism is the country's relatively low level of labor power. In Iceland, 90% of wage and salaried workers belong to trade unions authorized to fight for living wages and fair working conditions. In Italy, 34% of workers are unionized, as are 26% of Canadian workers. But only 10% of American wage and salaried workers carry union cards. The United States remains the sole advanced democracy missing a labor party, one dedicated, at least in original conception, to representing the interests of the working classes. Initially, American workers resisted the concept of wage labor, finding it antithetical to freedom and self-sufficiency. But as industrialization forged ahead while white indentured servitude declined, paying workers' wages became, according to historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar, the preferred labor system. As some of the world's first white industrial proletarians searched for a language to voice their grievances, they found traction in analogies to chattel slavery. Mill hands worked hours similar to those imposed on enslaved field hands, from dawn to dusk, and were dependent on factory owners for sustenance. In 1845, a labor newspaper referred to mill workers as white slaves of capital. An immigrant from Germany, a shoemaker, put it this way, "We are free, but not free enough." At inception, the American labor movement defined itself as a movement of and for white workers, a bulwark against their downward slide into wage slavery, blackness, and unfreedom. "Do not let them make inwards out of you," a machine stitcher told a crowd of mill workers in 1860, encouraging them to strike and demand a higher wage. Whiteness colored the American labor movement's initial identity and governed its boundaries of solidarity, ultimately limiting its power. White workers viewed black workers, both free and enslaved, as a threat to their livelihood. According to the pro-slavery New York Herald, if 4 million enslaved black workers were emancipated, they would flock to northern cities, and the labor of the white man will be depreciated. As documented by historian Joe Trotter Jr., white mobs throughout the first half of the 19th century attacked free black workers in Cincinnati, Philadelphia, New York City, and elsewhere because they were motivated by the hope that running black people out of town would drive up white wages. Slavery pulled down all workers' wages. Labor power had little chance when the bosses could instead choose to buy people, rent them, contract indentured servants, take on apprentices, or hire children or prisoners. Within this environment, white workers formed labor unions and advocated for better pay, improved conditions, and shorter workdays. Yet nearly all those unions withheld membership from free black workers. White workers viewed black people not only as rate busters, but also as political adversaries, since black constituencies were generally aligned with the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln and emancipation, but also the party of big business, while white union members sided with the Democratic Party, seen as more sympathetic to labor and immigrants. By upholding racial segregation within their unions, white workers made their fears of being undercut by black labor a foregone conclusion. Closing the door on black people created a pool of available and desperate men and women who could be used to break strikes and quell unrest. Companies hired black workers to put down labor militancy in a number of industries, replacing steelworkers, meat packers, longshoremen, railroad hands, and garment workers. To black workers, strike breaking was a means to gain a foothold in the growing industrial economy and to secure opportunities long denied them. Black leaders even encouraged strike breaking and began promoting black workers as safe investments for industrialists. Booker T. Washington, among the leading spokesmen for the black community during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, plainly said that black workers were very willing strike breakers, noting on another occasion that they were almost a stranger to strife, lockouts, and labor wars. Given the choice between parity with black people by inviting them into unified unions and poverty, white workers chose poverty, spoiling the development of a multiracial mass labor movement in America. That decision, wrote W.E.B. Du Bois, drove such a wedge between white and black workers that there probably are not today in the world two groups of workers with practically identical interests who hate and fear each other so deeply and persistently, and who are kept so far apart that neither sees anything of common interest. As northern elites were forging an industrial proletariat of factory workers who would replace independent craftsmen, southern elites, through the legislative and judicial branches they controlled, began creating an agrarian proletariat. In the mid-19th century, planters denied farmers animal grazing rights on common lands, undermining the ability of poor white people to subsist on their own and making them dependent on large plantation owners. They could quit, but quit and do what? During the decade leading up to the Civil War, southern planters, buoyed by the tide of rising cotton prices, squeezed white yeomen off their farms to expand their land holdings and plant more of the lucrative crop. The former freeholders often found work as overseers on the planters' ever-expanding estates, driving enslaved black hands. In Houston County, Georgia, for example, between 1850 and 1860, the number of households headed by overseers doubled, but the share of overseers who owned land declined dramatically, from 26 to 8%. The yeomen lost their farms, but retained their whiteness as consolation. If liberty could not be materially secured through landholding, at least it could be somewhat felt. Witnessing the horrors of slavery drilled into poor white workers that things could be worse, and American freedom became broadly defined as the opposite of bondage. This had the effect of making all non-slavery appear as freedom, as the economic historian Stanley Engerman has written. It was a freedom that understood what it was against, but not what it was for. A malnourished and mean kind of freedom that kept you out of chains but did not provide bread or shelter or means to get ahead. It was a definition of freedom far too easily satisfied, a freedom ready with justifications and rationalizations as to why some were allowed to live like gods while others were cast into misery and poverty, a freedom ready with the quick answer, hey, this is a capitalist society, a capitalist system, and capitalist rules. The staggering inequality that warps today's America characterized life here in the 19th century as well. By 1860, the top 5% of income earners had grabbed over a quarter of the nation's income, while the bottom 40% took home only 10.7%. Before the Civil War, inequality increased most dramatically in the South Atlantic states, where among free households, the share of income going to the top 1% almost doubled between 1774 and 1860, while the share going to the poorest 40% was cut in half. In 1860, 2 in 3 men with estates valued at $100,000 or more lived in the South, and 3/5 of the country's wealthiest men were enslavers. In the aftermath of the Civil War, America established twinned economic and political systems that pushed capitalists and workers further apart, creating winners and losers, the rich and the rest. Many formerly enslaved black workers were pushed into indentured servitude or imprisoned and leased out to companies as convict laborers, dual systems that replicated the antebellum cycles of racial subordination and exploitation, writes the historian Talitha LaFloria. Meanwhile, northern white elites became the most powerful in the world, shrugging off the Puritan frugality and modesty of their forebears, who had been rich but not spectacularly so, and had maintained an egalitarian affect. When Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States in the early 19th century, he remarked on how wealthy Americans keep on easy terms with the lower classes and speak to them every day. In fact, he remarked, the most opulent members of a democracy will not display tastes very different from those of the people. But the new elite, who had amassed significantly more money and power than the old guard, flourished their wealth, distanced themselves from the people, and became suspicious of, even antagonistic toward, democracy, just as several of the founders had been. It was easier to be restrained, it seems, when the money was. In 1935, Du Bois described the spirit of this new ruling class. Profit, income, uncontrolled power in my business, for my property, and for me. This was the aim and method of the new monarchical dictatorship that displaced democracy and the United States. Throughout the 20th century, labor made attempts to check the boss's power, but time and again these efforts were curtailed by the same racism that had divided workers both during and after slavery. In the years following World War I, racism pitted black workers against white veterans who felt entitled to the jobs black people had filled during the war. At mid-century, black factory hands, long shunned by unions, resisted white-led strike efforts, even coming to blows with picketers. Rare and muscular moments of multiracial solidarity, wildcat strikes that brought black and white workers shoulder to shoulder, biracial coalitions that sprang up spontaneously during walkouts so massive they humbled whole cities, provide a glimpse of what might have been. These were exceptions, however. More common was a labor movement prevented from realizing its full potential, hobbled by white workers too often persuaded that their whiteness was advantage enough. America has evolved into one of the world's most inequitable societies. Today, the richest 10% of Americans own over 75% of the country's wealth, with the top 1% owning well over a third. Many of the political systems, legal arrangements, cultural beliefs, and economic structures that uphold and promote this level of inequality trace their roots back to slavery and its aftermath. If today, America promotes a particular kind of low-road capitalism, a union-busting capitalism of poverty wages, gig jobs, and normalized insecurity, a winner-take-all capitalism of stunning disparities, not only permitting but rewarding financial rule-bending, a racist capitalism that ignores the fact that slavery didn't just deny black freedom, but built white fortunes, originating the black-white wealth gap that annually grows wider. One reason is that American capitalism was founded on the lowest road there is.